Hi, I'm Nick Rigoretti's, and this is the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, the show for grapplers and martial artists that want to evolve both on and off the mat. I can't believe we're already on episode 3 of the podcast. There already is an interesting energy, or a special energy, with this project. I find it's flowing much more easily than many of the other things in my life at this point. And today I had on a very close friend of mine, a man named Nick Raphael. Nick's not exactly a Jiu-Jitsu champion. He doesn't set the world alight with his skill or ability, but he has something that almost all Jiu-Jitsu players need and that many lack, and that is willpower. I've never met anyone as determined and tenacious as him, and it's led him to great success in life and on the mat. When it comes to sparring, he never ever gives up, and he received his brown belt from Roger Gracie at the age of 45, even after starting relatively late in Jiu-Jitsu. So I think he's got a lot of cool things to say, a lot of cool things to teach us, and I hope you enjoy episode 3 of the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast. Welcome back to the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood Podcast, and I'm here with my close friend, Nick Raphael, who's also a Roger Gracie brown belt. I'm actually in Nick's home in North London, and he's been kind enough to let me stay with him on this trip to London. As you guys know, I travel around, and I'm a bit of a vagabond at the moment. I'm moving to the States at the end of the year, and I had to come to the UK for a bunch of business meetings and just to do some work and also wait for my US visa to be processed. Nick very kindly let me stay in his home, which has helped me so much. I really appreciate that, Nick. Thank you so much for having me. Would you tell us a little bit about yourself and how, more importantly, how you came to train Jiu-Jitsu?
Hi, Nick. You're welcome in my home. So I'm a 45-year-old guy. Have worked in music and entertainment since I've been 16 years old. Officially, obviously, I went through the university process after being a failed professional soccer player. And then I ended up in music business. Very, very pleased to be it. It's turned out to be an incredibly exciting and eventful journey. And whilst I was in the music business, I came across a gentleman called Steve Finan, who's a very, very good friend, a friend of yours and mine. And he had met Maurizio. He was a student of Maurizio Gomez. And when Maurizio brought his son, Roger, to London, Steve, I believe, and I may be getting this wrong, but this is my interpretation of what I was told, said that they should set an academy up under Roger's name in London, and helped them found a venue and convinced them to set up the original Kensal Road Academy, which is where I met you, where I refused to do Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, and you were my PT trainer twice a week. And my kids were, or my son particularly, was in the first ever kids class at the Roger Gracie Academy in 2004 with Kev Capel's son. Mm-hmm. I still have pictures of it. I had the picture of the first class. Felipe D'Souza and Roger taught the class. Mm-hmm. And for 4 years, I refused to go anywhere near the mat. Had no interest in being hugging people in my pajamas. I thought it was all a bit weird. Wasn't my cup of tea, and you begged me for 4 years. And now, being a brown belt and being 9 years into jiu-jitsu, I wish I'd taken your advice in that period, because I probably would be, well, possibly, if deemed good enough, might be a black belt by now. Mm-hmm. But I'm enjoying my journey, and as I've seen from many of my black belt friends, black belt is just another chapter in the journey. So it's not the end, it's only the beginning. And the closer I get to that process, the more I realize that's the realization.
Mm-hmm. So Nick, the main reason I asked you to come on the show, besides the fact that you're a close friend of mine, and that one of the things I really love about you is you've always got something interesting to say. You've always got a cool story. Partly I think it's because of your pretty hectic life, being in the music industry and the entertainment business, but also partly because I think you look at the world in a certain way in which you're actively trying to collect these stories. That's not the reason I invited you on the show. The main reason I invited you on is because I think you have something to give the jiu-jitsu community, and that is an understanding of the concept of willpower. And I'll explain. So you're a brown belt now. How many stripes are you on?
None.
Okay. So I honestly never in a million years would have expected you to get a brown belt in jiu-jitsu. Not because for lack of willpower. It's just, A, when we started training, you didn't really seem to have much aptitude for it. And B, you started training very late in life. But let me tell you a little story that you don't know. I was talking about you with a mutual friend of ours, and he said that he was sitting on the mat with Roger and his father Mauricio Gomez, and your name came up, and they said the thing about you that they both admire and respect about you is you never duck anyone. Doesn't matter how big or tough or dangerous or young or strong the dude is, you'll spar with him, right? And you're not a big guy yourself.
67 kilos.
Yeah, which is like, what is that, 130 pounds?
155
pounds.
150 at the minute,
yeah. Okay. You're 45 years old. I mean, I'd say you've got some skills now, definitely, but it's not easy for you, right? And I remember when I was training you as a PT, there was something. Remember I used to give all my clients that test? I used to put them through this arbitrary test that I made up, just a general physical test of fitness. And I don't know what it was, but you would just never give up on anything, even if it was to your physical detriment. I remember you probably threw up a couple of times from working out there. And I'm interested to know where you developed that skill, or if it was an innate inborn ability. And I just want to know more about that, where you got that willpower from, because I think that it's a commodity that's incredibly valuable, not just in jiu-jitsu, but in life. And I think it would help everyone who's listening to this to find out how they could best use it or acquire it better in their lives.
Well, my jovial, humorous answer is I have small man syndrome. So that would be the first answer. The honest answer, and I've never been asked this question, and the one that's come to mind as you are asking the question, is my feeling that I'm actually not very good at anything, and I'm only averagely talented at best. So anything I've done, from music to academia, to playing professional sport, trying to be a professional soccer player, as the Americans would say, or football player, as the UK people would say, I have always wanted to be competitive, and I've always wanted to be recognized for being able to do stuff. And the reality is, I don't believe in any way, shape, or form that I have any real natural gifts. Maybe some people said the only natural gift you got is never shutting your mouth, and maybe this podcast will prove it. But the reality is that so the one thing I bring to everything is just an attempt always to do my best and not to shame myself, and to bring a sense of fun, a sense of if anyone wants to do something with me, I want to give it 100%. If that isn't good enough, sometimes, you know, some of my instructors, just to keep it on a jiu-jitsu thing, some of my instructors over the years have literally laughed in my face. Jude Samuel, I'll never forget, if you're listening to this, you humiliated me on one occasion on the mat where you taught a class I was in. When I asked you, what was I doing wrong? He said he didn't have enough time in the rest of the class. And even if it was a private, he wouldn't be able to correct my technique on whatever I was learning at the time. I think I was a white belt. And I asked him, and he just laughed. When he literally laughed in my face and said there was no time to actually fix the problem. And by the way, I was humbled and humiliated in that moment. And it always stayed with me. I love Jude, he's a lovely guy. But he really did put me down in one comment. The reality is, I think I just try my hardest. I believe that's all I can do. I got to give 100%. And sometimes it's good enough. And sometimes it's not good enough at all. And the times it's not good enough at all, I learn from, I hope. I rarely give up. And jiu-jitsu has been, you know, has been one of the greatest test. Like you said, I'm physically not very big. I'm relatively old to have started at 36, and I'm, you know, my flexibility is not great. My strength, you know, is okay for my size. It's not, you know, but then I'm one of the smaller guys on the mat. And I'm inspired by the brilliant people around me. And I'll never be the best, definitely not in my academy by a million miles. And fortunately, I'm not the worst. But I'm,
I think there's, so I appreciate that answer, but it doesn't really answer the question. I'm going to phrase it in a different way. So in Batman Begins with Christian Bale, the first one in the new trilogy.
Another film reference. I've listened to the other two podcasts. We've had 300 in one, and what was the other one in the other?
I can't remember.
And now Batman Begins.
Trust me, it'll make sense in a minute. Okay. He's they're in the training montage section of the film, and Liam Neeson, I'll never forget this line. He says to him, "The training is nothing. The will is everything." That always stuck with me. And I guess I refer to this as, I've asked about different versions of this, but I'm looking for the Jedi mind trick. When you're in the music industry and you told me you had a very dark period a few years ago before you became enormously successful. It was like the dark night of the soul, just the darkest part of the night just before the dawn. And I guess in Jiu-Jitsu, an analogy would be, or something similar would be, you know, this big guy like crushing you, and you're under the bottom of his north-south, and you can't breathe, and you just hang on, you look for that tiny little bit of space, and then you break through and reverse him, and the dawn breaks, you know. Like, what I'm looking for is, what is the Jedi mind trick that you're using? What is the thought that's going through your mind in either of those situations, whether it's work or business, or if you're having a family issue, or it's like, how are you fueling that tenacity that you so clearly have?
I'll go to the point where the darkest point where you brought up. In 2013 in January, I was preparing for the Europeans. I'd come off, you saw me fight. I got third in the senior and masters, and I felt like I was robbed against the winner. I think the winner told me, the guy who eventually won, who I lost in the semifinals, said he felt that he'd lost the fight and he won the fight. I didn't understand the rules correctly. We were stood up when I thought I already had his back. I was a novice at jiu-jitsu competitions. I was fighting a blue belt. I came third in the first world senior and masters, and I came flying back from that competition. I was going to win the Europeans. There's no question in my mind. I felt my jiu-jitsu was its strongest in sort of quality level, and I was overtraining. I got sick. I was not eating enough carbs. I was on some stupid diet because I got my head space into the fact I was already 10% body fat, and I was going to get down to like some stupid pre 10%, which is completely logical, but something stupid I got in my head. And I got a very bad thyroid illness caused by a virus. I called hyperthyroidism, viral hyperthyroidism. It was just awful. I got very, very sick, and it took me 18 months to recover, which is the normal recovery period. And I spent 6 months off the mat completely, then 6 months on the mat for about once a week, and then, you know, started to get back into twice a week training. And it took me 18 months to get to three times a week training. I was ruined. In that period, myself and my business partner, a girl called Jo Charrington, we had left our previous employer, which was Sony Music, and we'd had the most incredible purple patch. We were one of the three most successful in the UK, and what we call A&R teams, the people who go and find talent and develop talent and make records. And we were disproportionately successful. I could not believe we had the Medusa touch. Everything was going well. Went to a new company. I was, for the first time in my life, in a financial state where I knew my family would be safe, you know, as long as I didn't do anything stupid, because I was, you know, I'd hit a certain financial threshold. And I got sick. A year into doing the new company, I set up, no, just a year and a half, 18 months in. And we failed miserably for 18 months. In fact, we failed miserably for 3 years, of which 18 months of it was sick and 18 months of it was a setup period. Now, as Joe very intelligently said to me, it takes 3 years minimum to set a business up from scratch. And where did we think we were going to, or where did me, who has unrealistic goals, was going to set a business up that, you know, and have it profitable within 18 months? It just wasn't realistic. It wasn't sensible. Our business takes 18 months to bring an artist to the market. Mm-hmm. And the truth is, I was completely useless. And the truth is, the most incredible things in my life who brought me through was Joe, my business partner, who said to me, are you going to give up? Or are we going to get through this? My wife, who stuck by me, Amanda, who, you know, was very supportive. And I felt I couldn't let them down. But the reality is, I did get through that. And then obviously had this incredible run with a band called 5 Seconds of Summer, who had 2 number 1 albums in America within a 2-year period. And Sam Smith, who became one of the biggest artists on the planet. But the problem wasn't the fact that the dark period followed a very successful period. And I think the hardest thing, I'll get back to answering the question, the hardest thing for anybody, whether it's a jiu-jitsu competitor or a business person who has a business that does incredibly well and they sell it and they start a new business, is the expectation, the bar is so much higher than. If you've just won the worlds and you go to a local competition and get a silver, the silver is a negative. Mm-hmm. If you've never won a competition and you get a silver, it's a positive. Mm-hmm. Well, once you've won a gold and you've won a gold at the highest level,
and silver doesn't mean anything anymore.
Silver is valueless, which is not necessary. It's perspective of where it came from, mm-hmm. where you came from. There's a brilliant one in Liar's Poker, Michael Lewis, a brilliant book. One guy, his personal account while he's trading on that day had hit $1 million. He took the entire desk out for drinks that evening, celebrating. And as they're leaving, he sees another guy sat in the corner crying his eyes out, a grown man crying his eyes out. And they said, what happened to him? They said, oh, he had a $15 million personal account. He made the most unbelievably tricky and dangerous trade. And as of tonight, his personal account's gone down to $1 million and he's suicidal. But they both had $1 million. But from one, it was a celebration, and from the other, it's suicide. And I think that was part of the problem, unrealistic expectations. That goes with ambitions and competitiveness. And I don't know what brought me through. All I know is that the people around me reminded me, I've got good people around me. I always try and surround myself with people who are, one thing I always surround myself with, yourself included, are people who don't listen to any of my bullshit, cut through and just say, shut up, get on with it, stop being, I'm going to use a term I hope I don't offend anyone, stop being a pussy. You know, I think, Nikolai Holt said to me one time when I was moaning on the mat about something, and he said, and this is very sexist, so I apologize for his comment, was, do you want me to help you get the sand out of your vagina? Having said some of the toughest people on the mat are women, it was quite insulting. But anyway, he said that to me. I like being surrounded by people who just don't take any of my shit. I think that's why I'm attracted to jiu-jitsu, because the people on the mat, you know, they're not helping you out or being nice to you, because mm-hmm. you're 67 kilos and 45 years mm-hmm. old. So the actual answer is, I don't know what the driver is, but on that occasion, it was the people around me did not pander to my bruised ego and said to me, pull your shit together,
yeah.
get on with it, because either you're going to give up or you're going to get through this. And when the thought of giving up was put in front of me, I was like, fuck giving up. I'm going to get on with it. By the way, I also did do things like, and I read Tony Robbins, mm-hmm. I read Tim Ferriss, you recommended for 4-Hour Working Week. I went back and read some of those books, some of the inspiring things I loved, and I tried to get inspired. And by the way, it took a long fucking time to get inspired. But in that period, I keep saying by the way, but in that period, we did sign 5 Seconds of Summer and we did sign Sam Smith. And it always reminds me of how low I was, how the hell did me and Joe, and Joe brought Sam in 100% to us, did I manage to have the clarity to say, yeah, I get it, let's do Sam Smith and let's do 5 Seconds of Summer.
Yeah, dude, I mean, it's life's funny like that. I've noticed it in my own experience many times. Not only is it always darkest before the dawn, but very often the dawn or the light or the good thing that comes into your life you see later on that it had to have been born through that darkness. It needed that shitty situation for it to gestate and come to life, which it's easy enough to say that, but it's when you're going through the darkness that it's difficult to feel that.
Well, Mike Bidwell, I think he said in the previous podcast, because I listened to it, I think you and him were talking about that dark moment when you're in side control and someone's really smashing their shoulder into you. And some of those times then, one is believing in your jiu-jitsu, your technique or your ability to just breathe for a second. You've told me all the way through my jiu-jitsu, could you, Nick, calm down, breathe calmer, all those sort of things. And it, by the way, it definitely works to anyone out there who doesn't believe that. I can tell you 100%.
You can't tell them 100% because you're still not calm, bro.
Okay. So, and second of all, is in those moments, if you have a technique, which I have that lovely technique I love from sight, and you got yourself in that awful position, even though I'll go to a minute, remind me to tell you about Maurizio Gomez's side control defense when he taught it to me, which is my favorite side control defense. But is, you know, when I go to one of my go-to last minute ditch defenses and then it works and you're like, oh, you had to get to that moment to get that dark to actually believe in the technique. Let me just jump on it. Maurizio is one of my favorite teachers I've ever trained with. Once I asked him a thing about side control and he says, show me. And somebody did it. And then he says, come here. And I went to put my arm around his neck and head and to grab head control. And he pushed my hand away with his two hands. And I said, no, I need to get there. And he says, no. And I said, what is the defense to this side control? And he said, and he pushed my arm away again. I said, and he said that. He said, don't let them grab your head. And that was it. That was his defense to side control. Yeah.
It's don't let it happen in the first place.
Exactly.
Nick, I wanted to... it's, you know, you're surrounded by a bunch of very successful, very wealthy, in many cases, very famous people. And you and I were discussing something the other day. In spite of the fact that you've met all these people and been surrounded by them, I think, would you say it's safe to say that on average, the people you've met in jiu-jitsu have been the most interesting?
I would say that the people in jiu-jitsu has widened my life, widened my perspective, improved me as a human being. And I've loved the people I've met through the business that I've been in. But if I lived in that bubble all my life and didn't have the world of jiu-jitsu, I would be a very, very different person. Mm-hmm. And I love the humility of going in that changing room, putting on my gi. 95% of the people in most academies I go to, I travel all over the world and travel in academies, have no idea of the artists I work with, my title or my positioning within the record company. And they only judge me by my skills, my belt rank, my belt rank is a target sometimes as well, which is good and bad. And I get to meet people from all walks of life. You know, whether it's Pete who works at Amazon, who trains at Rogers, who I adore, and I went down and did a talk at his company, whether it's the Brazilians who I would never have met, and some of them are really unique and interesting. I believe Bruno, who's one of the black belts at Rogers, was a lawyer and he gave up being a lawyer to do this. Pablo in Spain, who runs Roger Gracie Malaga, he's also a lawyer. And actually, he is a lawyer now in his family's business, as well as running that academy. Wow. So I met so many interesting, and some people who work on construction sites or students or South African nomads. You know, I meet lots of people that are really interesting that became my friends, and I would, you know, I would do stuff for them, and you know, if they text me and ask me if I could help them out, I'd do stuff to help them out.
Yeah.
Whereas I think you're right, in my business I meet loads of interesting people that are my community, but it's a very small community and it's a bubble. It's not the real world.
So I'm reminded of a discussion we had a long time ago about Los Angeles, which is to me one of the most interesting places in the world. It fascinates me on every level. It's just an absolutely incredible city on all levels. And you said something to me which I subsequently found out to be true. You said that in LA, no one tells you the truth. No one will tell you the truth to your face. They won't tell you no to your face, especially in business. So I wanted to know, would you say that that doesn't occur in jiu-jitsu, even in LA, because there's no room for that. There's no room for that artificial bullshit, because, man, it's you against him. It's your skill versus his skill. It's so raw. And I guess my question is, that's probably one of the things that draws you to jiu-jitsu, and one of the things you love about it is, it's not like you're in a boardroom and you have to put in airs and graces or act in a certain way because you're with the head of Sony, or because you're signing a multi-million dollar deal and you have to put the best foot forward. You go to jiu-jitsu and it's just like you and the guy, and you're wrestling. And that's, do you get what I'm trying to lead towards?
100% agree. The comment about LA, exactly how I said it. I read Shoe Dog by Phil Knight, the guy started Nike. It's brilliant. And he talks about going to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And a yes is a no, and a no is a yes, and crazy shit. And he said, you got to understand Japanese culture. I think as an American, he's missed out. LA has its own version of Japan. I think New York is far more closer to London. I think the further you go east, as in from London, London's too brutal. New York is halfway between, and LA is, you know, it's closer to the crazy Japanese thing of, they say, yeah, let's do that. We'll definitely do it. And then you don't hear it from them for 6 months. And it's frustrating me through my life. You are 100% correct. I train in LA. I've trained at Robot with you. I've trained at Beverly Hills Jiu-Jitsu with Marcus Viniscus, who I adore. Sean Williams and Dane, I've trained with in Five Star. I've trained at Cropahinas with my friend Luke Mitzman, who's one of the students there. And the funny thing is, like you said, when I was in a boxing ring, and you know, I did those amateur boxing fights, when I used to do kickboxing, when I did taekwondo as a kid, the brilliance is you're as good as you are. I like that about sport in general. You know, when I used to play soccer, I used to get on the pitch and didn't matter. If the guy who was a postman was better than me and went past me, he went past me and they scored, and that's the way it went down. And I love that about jiu-jitsu. You know, I love the fact that one week I can get tapped out by someone in a lower belt than me, and another week I can tap out a black belt, you know, and that might be because the black belt switched off and didn't take me seriously. And it could be that the blue belt come or purple belt came looking for me and was bigger, younger and stronger. And, and you know, their game didn't fit my game, but there's no excuse. I tapped. And by the way, I tapped because that's the brilliant thing about jiu-jitsu, is you tap because you don't want to have a broken arm, or you don't want to go to sleep. Even though I think recently on the mat, Suzej, who's one of the...
Put you to sleep?
He, as close as damn it. My left leg was doing involuntary movements.
Oh, classic.
And then he said to me afterwards, hey, what was wrong with you? How did you put me to sleep, dude? Anyway.
That's wild. Yeah, Nick, so I wanted to ask you, this story is completely unrelated to jiu-jitsu, but I think it's fantastic. It's one of my favorite of all your stories. You met Prince.
Yes.
Back in the day. I remember I was with a buddy in LA. We were at a famous, fantastic restaurant, and you related the story to us. Would you kindly tell that story again, please?
It's a crazy, crazy, weird story. I work for a legendary music executive called Clive Davis, who's written a book and there's a documentary about him. He's one of the greatest A&R guys, music executives that ever lived. He was a lawyer. He became head of a label. He signed, I believe, and I apologize if I get any of this wrong, I believe he signed The Grateful Dead. He signed Simon & Garfunkel. He was involved, his company signed Whitney Houston. I think another guy brought it in. He signed it. He made the records. He made a deal with L.A. Reid, who later did Pink, Tony Braxton, blah, 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 blah. He did Puff Daddy. He made a deal with Puff Daddy. He was a legendary, legendary music executive, the best of the best of modern times. And he came to London, and I was the head of A&R for his UK company. He ran a company called Arista. I was the head of A&R for the UK company. My boss insisted on a Sunday night that we go for dinner with Clive, an Italian restaurant called Zaffarano's. I'm at the Italian restaurant. My wife has said, what time you'd be home? I said, about 10 o'clock. We're going out for dinner at 7. There's no way it'll take longer than 3 hours, even with traveling time. I eat the meal, and at the end of it, he said, would you like to come back to my hotel room with a couple of his executives and my boss to listen to some music that he's going to be releasing later in the year through his company? I said, yeah, no problem. On the journey over, he gets a phone call, and he tells us the artist is coming to his hotel room in the Dorchester suite to listen to music as well. He just said the artist. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, cool. So I was like, shit, this is going to be a late night. Anyway, I send a text to my wife that says, sorry, not going to make it home by 11. Got to go to Clive's suite to hear some music. And the artist is coming over and we've got to hang and listen to some music. She calls me as I arrive. And then I realize when I got to his suite, the artist formerly known as Prince. And she calls me and I'm in his suite in the corridor outside of the living room. And she's saying, Sunday night, and you're hanging out with some random artist. I haven't seen you all week. I wish you'd come home. You know, you've done the dinner with Clive. You know, you don't have to schmooze all evening, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah. And I'm like, listen, I think the artist has just arrived. Anyway, next walks through the door, Larry Graham from Sly and the Family Stone, who's a legend bass player, Prince, and, well, who wasn't called Prince at the time, and his security. And they say hi to me in the corridor. I said, Amanda, I've got to go, and I put the phone down.
No, we should preface this next part by letting the audience know that you were a huge fan of Prince.
The biggest fan. The biggest. Really. Okay. So we go into this suite, and I then sit back down in my seat on the sofa, and Prince now sits directly next to me, and Larry Graham from Sly and the Family Stone sits, so the three of us on the sofa, and the security stood behind, and executives are in the room,
and at this point, music. At this point, you're a relatively junior music executive.
Oh, I am at this point. This must be, I think, 99. Definitely before I left to go to Sony. So I'd say 99, maybe 2000, 17 years ago.
Okay.
And I was making a name for myself, but I definitely was not regarded in the upper echelon.
So you were like a blue belt, two stripes.
Yeah. I think that's, you're being nice. Okay. So yeah, okay. I definitely wasn't playing at the top table. And you get in this room, and the other executives with Clive, my boss has left, and the other executives with Clive, I'm left in the room, and his other executives are so deferential, they call him Mr. Davis. And I keep calling Clive, because he's calling me Nick. So if you call me Mr. Raphael, I call you Mr. Davis, but he's calling me Nick, so I'm calling him Clive. It's, you know, that's, I think to me, that's the human courtesy. Mm-hmm. Anyway, so Clive's playing music and everything else. And I am dying to ask Prince a question. I am so big a Prince fan. And I can smell his aftershave. His hair chest is coming out in his purple shirt. He's got the symbol coming out on with like a diamond crusted symbol. He's wearing like heeled shoes. He looks as magnificent as you want him to look. He's small like me. You know, he's probably not much bigger than me at the time. And so the room goes quiet. And I was like, I've got to ask him a question. And I haven't spoken, even though I speak all the time at this point, because it's Clive's show in his room and Prince is on the couch. And I said, can I ask you a question? Looking him in the eye, because I didn't know what to call him, because to call him the artist, the symbol, what do I call him? Yeah. So anyway, he says, what's your question? And the whole room goes silent, like broken protocol. I said, the Love Sexy album. He's like, yeah. I said, you know, like when you get a CD, each track has a PQ point. So if there's 12 tracks, you have 12, when you put the CD in, it says 12, and then you can flick from one track to the other. Mm-hmm. Well, Love Sexy album doesn't have a PQ point. Even though it has 9 tracks or 10 tracks or 12 tracks, however many it's got, and I can't remember how many it had on it, it has one, it just says one track when you put it in. And my favorite track was Anastasia. Anastasia, come to me, praise me, praise me, liberate your mind. Anyway, I won't sing the song. I can't sing for Toffee.
Thank you, Nick.
My pleasure. So at which point I said, so why did you only have one PQ point? Because I was like the biggest fan of you, and Anastasia is my favorite song. And every time I listened to the album, I had to forward rewind it on my CD player to 22 minutes, 36 seconds to get to that song. And it pissed me off, if I'm honest with you. I've just criticized the greatest musical icon, in my opinion, of modern times. And he says, here's silence in the room. He said, you did what? I said, well, I didn't understand, man. Why was there only one PQ point? And I had to rewind, you know, and as a fan, this really annoyed me. And he says, you disrespecting me like this? And the whole room is like, I've ruined my career. I'm over. I've gone from being a blue belt to a
taekwondo practitioner.
I'm being thrown out of the academy. Okay. There is no question in my mind. And it felt like a minute, but it probably was like 10 seconds or 12 seconds. of like pregnant pause. And then he slaps me on my thigh or punches me in my arm in a playful way and said, Clive, at last you got a guy working for you who's really into music. I love this guy. And he said, Nick, the reason why I did that was I wanted people to listen to my album in its entirety and not flick tracks like you did.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, but I respect the fact that your favorite song was Anastasia. And I know a lot of fans found that frustrating. And I didn't do that again. But that was my mindset. And he said, but I'm pleased to see that you're a real music fan. Mm-hmm. And amazing that you love my music as well. And I was like, yeah. He goes, let's go and party. And I ended up in a nightclub on a Sunday night.
Fuck.
And to call my friend, Omar, who's a DJ at a club called Twice As Nice, to organize with the promoter. He used to DJ there. He wasn't there that night. To ask the promoter, Steve, if I could bring some guests. And he's like, who's your guest? And I had to leave the room because I couldn't say to him the artist. He'd say, what do you mean, which artist? And I couldn't say Prince in front of Prince because he was really sensitive about using that name. Because at the time, he was liberating himself. And you remember, he'd gone through the slave period. So I'm now in the corridor going, Prince, it's Prince. And he's going, it's who? And I was going, Prince, Prince. Yeah. Speak up. And I was like, it's Prince. Anyway, we get to nightclub. He couldn't believe it. He was like, you have brought Prince to my nightclub. I was like, yeah, dude. And he said, who's the old guy? I said, Larry Graham from Sly and the Family Stone. And that was the last bit of the story, which sort of the main bit was that. But I said to Prince at one point when we were in the nightclub, why are you walking around with like this old guy who's like wearing the worst suit that your dad would wear? He said, why are you wearing? He goes, do you know who Larry is? And I was like, no, because I didn't know who Larry was. And he's like, Larry Graham. It's like, okay. He said, he was the bass player in Sly and the Family Stone. He said, Sly and the Family Stone was the funkiest band of all time. I was like, okay, cool. And he goes, so the bass player must have been the funkiest bass player of all time. So I went, okay. And he goes, can't you feel those funky vibes? And I was like, no, not really. But anyway, it was an incredible, insane night. And I spent 48 hours with him. And he's obviously now, unfortunately, passed. But as a fan, those 48 hours, incredible. You know, as crazy and as incredible, because I take it for granted, I train at his academy. You know, in jiu-jitsu terms, having Roger giving you, like, you know, giving you 2-3 hours of his attention and hanging with you and talking jiu-jitsu and doing hanging. And who's the crazy guy next to him? Oh, it's my dad, Maurizio Gomez. You know, it felt like that. And can you feel the jiu-jitsu vibes?
That's cool.
It was like, yeah.
That's awesome, man. You know, Nick, just bringing the conversation again back around to jiu-jitsu, I'm putting you on the spot a bit with this question. I should have probably given it to you before the interview so you could prepare for it, but what do you think is the one most important thing or the biggest gift that jiu-jitsu has given you?
In an incredible period in my life that has been, particularly in my work, been very, very successful, it gives me humility on a daily basis, and it's probably the most valuable thing and the thing I most need. So you know, there's a couple of things I remember. I remember something, it's nothing to jiu-jitsu, but takes me back to jiu-jitsu. My friend called me the weekend that Sam had, so I come back home after Sam had won 4 Grammys out of 6.
Been at the Oscars, right?
This one was the Grammys.
Oh, the Grammys.
And he'd won 4 out of 6, and it's his first Grammys, it's incredible. And I was in my garden at my old house, and I had to take my dog out, and I went out with one of those plastic bags because the dog had done a shit basically in the garden. And I was picking up, my friend called me, and I pulled my phone out of my back pocket, and he said, oh my God, man, how's it feel to win 4 Grammys? And I said, dunno. I said, oh, at the moment I'm picking the dog shit up in the garden. And he just laughed. Yeah. And it's like, doesn't matter what happens, you still got to pick up the dog shit. If your child's ill and they're sick, you still got to clean the sick up. And what I loved during the whole period when all this stuff was going on, I was going to Sean Williams, I was going to Marcus Viniscus. Every time I go to LA, I train with all these people.
Mm-hmm.
And I was getting tapped out. And I'm thinking, this is about to be the biggest night of my life. And everyone in business is high-fiving me. And I get to the academy and people are arm-barring me and they're trying to smash me and I'm having to fight for my dear life. And I was like, shit, I need... At the point when everyone's blowing smoke up my ass, I was getting to the gym. Yeah. And I don't think anyone however good, I've seen Roger train in the gym. I saw Roger train the other night because he's got these big fights coming up. Mm-hmm. And we're in the competition class, and every single competitive guy in the gym, and he's our master and a professor, they're trying to kill him. Not in a nasty or spiteful way. They want to see how far they can go against the best. And I think, you know, and yeah, he comes off and people high-five him and everything else. But it was amazing watching him step his game up to sweep some of them more, mm-hmm. or to submit some of them, or to, you know, to get top position on them, or to get to mount, God forbid, against him. And what's brilliant is, even though he is at that level, and he's like the artist as opposed to me just being executive behind the artist, when things are going in great guns, I come to the mat and I'm back to being the purple belt that I was at the time of the Oscars, mm-hmm. or at the time of the Grammys. And I get into an academy and there's someone there who makes my life misery that morning. And I thank them for it. I don't thank them at the time. In my head, I'm like, I'm grateful for that person having no idea who I was, why I'm there. And they say, oh, what are you in town for? And I'm like, oh, I'm here, you know, clients doing this or whatever. And they say, oh, cool. All right, let's do some jiu-jitsu.
Yeah, that's cool.
And it's brilliant. It's the most humbling, it's the most brilliant, and yeah, it resets your clock.
That's fantastic. Nick, so you mentioned earlier that you were in a period where people were blowing smoke up your ass, and I was thinking about how to close this chat. I knew it was going to be a fun one. I knew you were going to tell some cool stories. The other reason I brought you on the show is I just want to honor you and thank you for your friendship, and to tell you that I wouldn't be able to be doing things like this, like doing podcasts, and I don't think my brand and Jiu Jitsu Brotherhood would be where it is now if it wasn't for you. And I want to thank you so much for that. And you know, if someone had called me an hour before this and said, you can have Andre Galvao on the show or Marcelo Garcia on the show, but it has to be now, I would have turned them down. I would have chosen you over them any day of the week. Because to me, you epitomize what jiu-jitsu is all about. And bless you, Nick. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. Okay.
You want to give a shout out to anyone else before we go?
I just got to say, that's the first time in my life I've ever been put on the same level as Andre Galvao.
And the last time as well. Okay, guys, until next time, peace out.
Cheers.
That was a lot of fun, and it was also really easy. There's a reason they call him Nick the Mouth Raphael. He's always got something to say. Fortunately, most of the time, it's pretty interesting. The thing that I find most fascinating about Nick Raphael is he lives in this world. He actually was one of the people who introduced me to this world that is, it's just so far beyond what I came from. He's a very wealthy and successful individual, and as he mentioned in the show, he spends time at things like the Grammys and the Oscars, and you know, rubs shoulders with all these celebrities. And I find it interesting that he keeps coming back to the jiu-jitsu mat. You know, it's the one thing he's most passionate about in his life. I can see it's the thing that pumps him up now. He lives in this amazing house, drives a fantastic car, travels around the world on these exotic vacations, has a very challenging and rewarding career, but the thing he's fired up about, the thing he's talking about, is jiu-jitsu. And just like he said in the show, it's a thing that's kept him humble. And for me, it's slightly different. It has kept me humble, but it's more that it's kept me quite literally grounded. There have been times in my life when I've been, let's just say, experimenting with certain substances and certain paths and journeys, where jiu-jitsu has been the one thing that's probably saved me from losing my mind. It's such a powerful cure-all for many of the things that plague us. And I find it's kind of cool how a guy like Nick Raphael, it's become one of the most important things in his life, even though he picked it up relatively late in life. And even though he's not the most talented guy in town, he still goes there and gives it his best. And there's no excuse for anyone in their 40s, or anyone who's a busy executive, or anyone who has a family and children, Because if a guy like Nick Raphael can do it, then you can too. I hope you guys enjoyed episode 3 of the Jiu-Jitsu Brotherhood podcast, and I'll chat to you again in a week or two. Peace out. We'll be right back.